session number 24898-1.
Genevieve Camus, Reel 1. Can you tell me if there was any tradition of military service in your family?
No. My mother was English, Mary Waite, W-A-Y-T-E, married to a Frenchman, Marcel Soulier, S-O-U-L-I-E, acute. She came over to France after the World War I and stayed there. Never went back to England, married, and I was the eldest of three.
When you
my name is, my maiden name is Soulier, S-O-U-L-I-E.
When you were growing up, did you ever anticipate that there would be another major war in Europe?
Well, I was born in 1922. And whenever my father met a few friends, they always talked about the First World War and the rats and the trenches and difficult war and what have you. And I thought in my own little mind, 4 or 5 years old, 6 years old, that must have been the back in the medieval times, that story. It bothered me more than anything else. My aunt, who was my father's sister, always telling me, "Your poor grandmother, who died when she was 52 and I was 2, your poor grandmother has seen the Paris, the Prussians came right to Paris in 1817. So that was the only things I heard about war, my father and my aunt, because of my grandmother. Then I grew up and my parents had separated, and therefore I didn't want on studying. I started working at the age of 15.
What work were you doing?
So I started in a tourist shop selling Eiffel Towers and what have you at the bottom of Sacré-Cœur, if you know the place. Still there, the shop is still there. And then I changed into different jobs. I was 15, 16, and I wasn't 17 when the war. I'm born on the 25th of September, 22. So therefore, just before I was 17, the war was declared. And I thought, then I will wait till I'm 18. I will learn to drive, and I will go into the army and drive an ambulance or something like that. But I didn't have time to do that because we were invaded next spring.
Did the outbreak of war as such come as a surprise to you?
I don't think so, really. looking back on it, because my mother was there. Well, my mother being, she was French by marriage.
Not by birth.
Not by birth, but still. And she did say, when I was about 11, I think, she did say, oh, the Germans again. There was a business about the Ruhr. And in a way, yes, it did. Probably did disturb me a bit, but not that much. I mean, I was a child.
You weren't politically minded at that age?
Not at 11, I suppose. Except that our generation has always been against the Germans.
What happened to you in 1940 when the campaign began?
At that time I was working in what we call a crematorium for children. You know, there was a lot of tuberculosis in those days, and some children were taken up off their families to put in a special, we can't call it a hospital, but a
sanatorium?
Crematorium, which is not quite the same. They were not ill, but they were predisposed to be to get the illness, and therefore I wasn't then at that time. I had done different jobs, but then at that time I was in that crematorium, which was in C. C is in the Orne. It's Normandy. C is S-E-E-S.
Very much an ecclesiastical centre.
And I was there, and from what, 39, and so the 1940 spring, we opened a place to get the refugees from Belgium and then the north, and then we were refugees ourselves. We went down 4 days and four nights to get down to a center belonging to the same. It was the what we call in those days the social insurance, which is the Sécurité Sociale now. Mm. And so we were down to Ardailles, near the Spanish borders. But we were not there for 48 hours that the Germans came arrived.
When you were travelling south to Ardailles, how were you moving? Were you moving on foot or in vehicles or by train?
No, we had a train.
You had a train?
4 days and four nights on a train. Nothing much to eat except the Red Cross sometimes. Gave us some food, ham, I remember, ham and bread. And then nothing much more.
Was this train to evacuate the children?
The children, yeah. Mm.
Did they all get there safe?
Yes, we got down to Ardailles very safely. But then we had a nice place in Ardailles, and we had to move out next day because the Germans took every big building to the army. Mm. I can't go there without seeing them coming on the road against the coast and piling down, very, very proud. And I can still see them.
What impression did they make on you when you saw them?
I'm a bit of an English, and I thought, well, we've lost the war. Well, what about it? But I was soon disappointed, I must say. I mean, It wasn't as I thought, you know, a tennis round, and you say, you know, shake hands and that's done.
The Germans weren't sportsmen, in that sense.
Well, of course, not understanding anything, I don't speak German, but we were guarded by the Germans, actually, and asked to, a child wanted to get out or something of the place, and I said, I couldn't say it in German, so he didn't understand French, so I said it in English. I must say, I can't remember what he did, but he turned his back on me and turned green, I suppose. Not supposed to speak English. But very... only little facts I'm there. But after a week, we had nothing to eat. We had only fish, breakfast fish, lunch fish, dinner fish, nothing left. And of course, everything was dissolved, so I had to go back home.
Was that in Paris?
There was no home for me, because my mother was ill in those days. She had been ill. She has been ill for 17 years and finally died. She was ill when I was 11. We were separated. She was taken into a hospital, sanatorium, and stayed there 2 years. And she was out and bought with the help of her relatives in England. She bought a small house, a small cottage in Normandy, and because she couldn't live in Paris with his siblings. And then the Germans came, so she had nothing. She had no pension anymore.
Was the pension being paid from England?
From her brothers.
Yes.
In England. Therefore, I was the one to my brother and sister are twins. My brother and sister are 5 years younger than me. So I was the one to bring money home.
How did you do that?
As much as I could. Mm. I had this job and another job, and then I was fired from this job in the crematorium because all the children were sent back home. Mm. So I came back to Paris and with the help of friends I found another job, which was looking after children at a doctor's place, opening the door and by doing the housework. I was supposed to speak English to the children, but English was forbidden in those days. And doing the housework and doing the laundry and doing everything, doing the queues for food. I stayed there about 2 years, I think. And then I went into also by through friends, I got a job as in a library.
Wow. What was your first contact with the resistance? How was that made?
Well, I must go on with my little story because that was rather funny. Coming back to the place, the doctors. The doctor and his family lived in a very nice house on the 16th arrondissement, a private house. And it was a ground floor, but underneath it's
cellar, basement.
Basement. And ground floor, first floor was a doctor's place, visiting, and second floor, the whole family was packed. That was the only place there was some heating. Mm. On the first floor, there was a stove which we tried to get going, and there wasn't a proper coal to put in it, so it was very difficult. But anyway, he tried to have a bit of heating for the patients when they came. And of course, the basement was empty, and that was actually the proper kitchen and maid's rooms. So that's the only little piece that was rather fun. I was there when there was Boulogne, you know where Boulogne is, it's in the west of Paris. Boulogne was bombed, and I was coming back, and it was night. I came back and said, "Oh, if only an airman came down, I would put him in the basement and feed him." And that is what I did afterwards. Funny enough.
You got your wish.
Got my wish. No, I never used the basement, of course, I was gone from there. Mm. I was in the air. And that I agree. That was very hard days, very hard days. I wasn't learning much. I was living in a girl's pension, they called it. The food was terrible, if any. And a friend of my family for years and years and years, still we're still friends. This lady, she died when she was 98, I think. This lady was doing good charity work in the 4th arrondissement. The 4th arrondissement, it's a Jewish, was a Jewish part. So she looked after a dispensary, all benevolent work, and she tried to separate the children, send them to country places, farmers who would take them, and she was doing a summer camp too, and the summer camps for 1 year or two. She asked me, first she was a widow, she had a nice big apartment in Paris. So she was a widow with not much money, so she took pensioners. And she asked me while she was going to do her summer camp in the summer, she asked me, would I look after her pensioners? So of course, I was not paid, but I was fed. And
you were lodged.
So I said yes. And that year, the pensioner was in.
Wow. And was this lady Madame Flamand?
Madame Flamand.
Ah. And how did he first make it known to you what he was doing and that he would want your help?
Well, very soon. Mm. Actually, very soon. He's talked to me like you are doing now, asked me questions. I said, my mother was English, and he said that. And then he thought perhaps that's a good recruit. So he asked me, he told me, would I like to help him? I said, oh yes. He said, oh no, you mustn't answer like that. You must think it over. It's dangerous, and so on. So next morning, I said, yes. Didn't sleep a wink, of course, all night, and said, I said, still yes.
What thoughts were going through your mind during that sleepless night?
Oh, I was thrilled. I think I've never been so happy.
What was making you happy? The idea that you'd be doing something positive?
My life was nothing. A very poor life. I couldn't see any. I had no background study. The only thing I knew was English talk. I didn't tell you why I speak English, of course. Not because my mother was English, because she was deaf, stone deaf, and she couldn't be bothered. But she never lost her accent, of course, being deaf. I suppose somehow I heard it. And just like you find the same voice in children, you know, they said, oh, you sound like your father, or you sound like your mother. So I think that must have done it. And when she got into the sanatorium because of her TV, I was sent to England.
Which part of England did you go to?
Yorkshire.
Which part of Yorkshire?
Filey.
Filey, yes. So up the coast from Bidlington. Well, they speak a very distinctive form of English there.
Yes, I don't know now because I've worked with Americans, I've worked with English, I've worked with all sorts of accents, of course. But in those days, they came to me, you're not English. I said, no, I'm French. I said, you've got a Yorkshire accent. Made me laugh. But anyway,
Brucine had asked you, and you had your sleepless night, but you were delighted to be asked. And what did Brucine ask you to do when you first started working with him?
In a way, I think I've always thought that he was preserving me.
Saving you for later?
No, not saving me for later, saving me from the worst thing that could have happened, but somehow didn't happen. But he was a very, very, very good chief, that I must say. And I was very, very, very disciplined person. He said, there's no walking around, taking them around Paris, showing them the sights and things. You mustn't do anything like that. You mustn't do anything more than what I'm asking you to do. So I kept like that. And that, I think, saved me.
Well, what was it you were supposed to do with regard to the airmen?
I was supposed to find places to lodge the
And how did you go about doing that?
Well, somehow, you know, when I wasn't the first one, of course, we took over the different comet and different réseau, which were of course, one or two places that I had to start with. Then one would say, that's an Arab telephone, of course, one would say, well, my friend so-and-so would take one. And I had all sorts of people. That's what made things difficult afterwards, because we had I had a policeman, his wife and child, and they took, there were always one or two Americans sleeping on the child's bed, and the bed, the child would sleep between father and mother or on the carpet. And I would say, that's something, I would say, aren't you afraid about the child speaking and talking at school? Oh no, she won't say anything. She never said anything. And all sorts of places. There was a young girl. She would put a sheet between her bed and the pilot's sleeping on the floor. And it was like that. Everybody wanted to help. And you wouldn't think anything wrong.
So was it then just an informal network of personal contacts that was giving you places where you could put pilots and airmen?
Well, finally I had a number of places. About
15.
All sorts of people, and very rich people and very poor people and very...
Did they have anything in common? Yes, all these different sorts of people.
And that either, I didn't want to... Actually, I didn't like them to know each other.
Was there any particular sort of place or type of place that was particularly suitable for lodging these airmen when they were on the run?
No, they had to take it as it was. Well, of course, my job was to speak to the airmen to know. Get their identity.
Yes. How did you do that? What sort of things did you ask them?
Their number, their name, number, nationality, age, grade. And I put it on I've got some still, cigarette paper. Oh. I rolled it in a little ball I could swallow. If anything happened. And I had to look after them in a way of when we had a parachuting, we got some cigarettes, we furnished them with cigarettes, a bit of food sometimes, a bit of money. Many of them were not paid very large, but food was a problem. And the main problem was clothing.
Oh.
And the worst problem was shoes.
Why was that?
There was no, all the clothing was with tickets.
Rationed.
We had very, very strict rationing. As to shoes, we had none. I used to sew my soul every morning. We were that bad. And the Americans, of course, they were twice as tall as me and had feet like that. So I got lengthened the trousers as much as I could. But still, you could see the beautiful leather shoes coming out. I don't know how the Germans never noticed that. But
were these their own shoes?
You couldn't get the shoes for them. So I had to do all that, go and see, and of course talk to them, because some of them got quite frenzy. They would jump out of the window sometimes when it started being in their idea too long. They thought perhaps they were taken driving up the wall or something, you know. They didn't think we were liable to send them over.
How long normally did they have to stay waiting in?
Anything between 3 days and 3 months.
But was there a point at which most of them started to become anxious and fidgety because they were...
None. It depended on the... It depended on the man himself and perhaps... when they were two, it was usually better.
They could entertain each other.
They could, and they could, of course, speak. They could understand. They could, but they were not supposed to go out. But some people to be not. They worship it.